I'm glad to see so many people here are interested in Emily Dickinson. She's a fine poet. I guess I don't need to tell anybody that. She was born in 1830 and died in 1886. And she lived all of her life in Amherst, Massachusetts. Went to school there for a while. And she has a reputation of being a recluse, of having taken a look at life early on and decided she didn't need it. An unhappy, an unrequited love. It was unrequited because the man she was in love with didn't know she was in love with him. He didn't even give her the option of being unrequited or not. And she carried the torch for this guy for 20 years, and he never did find out. We're not exactly sure who it was she was supposedly in love with. Critics narrowed it down to a couple of people, but nobody's sure. Not that it matters a whole bunch. Both of the people, it's not important particularly, but both, just for the record, both men are not, neither one of them were worthy of her anyway. They were both sort of oafish, and she was way ahead of her time, certainly way ahead of them. Why anybody's in love with anybody is a mystery anyway, right? But there we are, and she kind of retreated into her, if you can call it a retreat, into her father's house in Amherst, and he had a great library there, and she read and knew all the classics, read Shakespeare, theology, and grew up and spent the rest of her life in her father's garden. And as time went on, she went out less and less until finally she didn't go out at all. And what people she saw, she might see them walking through the town, and they might see a white-robed figure moving past the window, and they say, "There's Nutty Emily. She doesn't come out and talk to us, you know." So she got quite a reputation as being a recluse and eccentric, and then just slightly off. But she wasn't at all. She was perfectly content, as far as anybody can be perfectly contented. And she had quite a life, and it was a very full life, and she read, she talked to a few people, some old friends would come into the house. She did get a bit eccentric about that. Sometimes, after a while, she wouldn't even talk to them face to face. She might be behind the next wall back there, and the person would sit down, they'd talk through the wall. It's a little Howard Hughes-ish. I was doing a session on Emily Dickinson in the mid-70s in Chalet 1. And when Carol and Mary Henderly were here, and I was talking about Emily Dickinson, and I heard this voice talk to me. I looked up to see who was, and there was nobody in the room. I thought, am I hearing things? And the voice came again. I looked around, and I went around, and it was Mary Henderly sitting behind the wall talking to me. And I thought, Mary, have you turned into an Emily Dickinson? Well, Mary Henderly has a tremendous allergy problem, and dust really got to her. And the carpet in Chalet 1 was full of dust, so she preferred to sit on the other side of the wall and just rather than be bothered. But it was unnerving for a while, because I wasn't sure why she was doing that, where those voices were coming from. Emily Dickinson is when I read Robert Frost, I'm convinced Frost is America's greatest poet. When I read Emily Dickinson, I'm convinced she is. And then when I read Whitman, I'll be reading Whitman Friday, I'm convinced he is. What that means is that Frost, Dickinson, and Whitman are the three greatest American poets, and everybody else has to stand in line. And I guess you can kind of take your pick who you like best. Certainly, Emily Dickinson is one of America's greatest poets and one of the world's finest poets, virtually unpublished when she was alive, maybe a half a dozen poems. But she left almost 2,000 poems. And luckily for her, for us, her sister disobeyed her dying wish. She said, "Lavinia, my poems are in a cardboard box under the bed. Burn them." Lavinia says, "I'll do it." And then she didn't. Of course, she published them, which is fine, because otherwise we wouldn't have this record. Interestingly enough, I ought to do a session sometime on artists who have burned and destroyed their works, whether it be painting, musical scores, or poems, or books, or novels, and why they've done that. Almost always, we find that it was a shame that they did it. Either they realized a, quote, religious conversion of one kind or another, and they felt they wanted to repudiate their work. That almost never works. Okay, enough about it, her life. I mean, that's pretty much it. She grew up reading all these things, I said, and she read a lot of theology, and she was certainly acquainted with Jonathan Edwards and the Puritan frame of mind, sinners in the hands of an angry God, the kind of thing where Jonathan Edwards talks about God holding us by a string over, if I had a spider over this fire, let it, that's what we would be over the yawning pit of hell, Jonathan Edwards said, and we're just like a little loathsome spider on a thread, and God dangles us, and we never know when the flames are going to burn the thread and we're going to drop into hell. Well, that's great reading, and it was guaranteed to scare little Puritan kids just before they went to bed, and it's been scaring people ever since. The Puritan tradition in America is very strong, the work ethic and getting and building and saving and producing and all that, and growing bigger tomatoes and being a good citizen, that's very good. The other side of it, the negative side, is something Freud and other people have been interested in, what it's done to your psyche. Anyway, she was steeped in that. And then along came Ralph Waldo Emerson, who completely blew that right out of the water. And Emerson said there's no such thing as this and that. It's unlimited vistas and the Western expansion, and Whitman took that up with Song of Myself. Everything was expanding, was open, was horizonless, was free. Whitman said, he who would be a man must first be a nonconformist. Well, boy, that's not what Jonathan Edwards said about holding you over the gaping pit. Emily didn't know who to believe. And he also said, nothing is sacred but the integrity of your own mind. Nothing. Not the Bible, not the creed, not the this and that. So she was reading all these things, and she found herself torn between Puritanism, the Puritan work ethic, the ideal, and Emersonian transcendentalism, that there are some truths that transcend what we can prove, that we intuitively know things in our guts, and we don't have to have it proved by a test tube or have a scholar tell us it's true. It's just true because we know it's true. Those two things were active in New England, and our girl Emily is right in the middle of it. Her poems are very short. They're no more than 3, 4, 5 stanzas. They always rhyme. We read some Robert Frost the other day. Sometimes Frost rhymes, sometimes he doesn't rhyme. Emily always rhymes. And her Frost said a poem should begin in wisdom, begin in delight and end in wisdom. Dickinson didn't say anything about how poems should be. She just wrote them. And usually very sharp and incisive. Very often the last line is something like a safe falling out of a window, mashing you when you least expect it. For a smallish, genteel New England lady, she had a tremendous wallop. So with that, by way of kind of setting the stage of who she is, this is a poem called Success is Counted Sweetest. Success is counted sweetest by those who never succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he, defeated, dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear. This is an informal session about Emily Dickinson, so I hope you'll feel free to ask me to repeat a poem, or if you want to talk about it, or if you want to ask me what I think it means, just do that. Normally, I don't harangue about a poem. I tend to just read them and let it go, and you can chew on it later or now, whatever. But Emily Dickinson is not like Robert Frost. With Frost, you can read a poem, and almost immediately, you're with the poem. You can see the setting. Dickinson is a little tougher, a little trickier. So if you want me to repeat something, or you want to talk about a certain line, send up a hand and let's do that, okay? I don't want to just gloss these over because sometimes without you having them in front of you, you're an unfair advantage.
What was the title of that one?
Success is Counted Sweetest. Actually, the whole poem is contained in the first two lines. Success is counted sweetest by those who never succeed. Now, that's typical Dickinson. That's that incisive, ironic wit.
It's true.
Absolutely. There's a certain slant of light is a good poem, very fine poem. It has a couple of images. Any of you from the Midwest or from the East? I'm from Southern California. We don't get a whole lot of autumn or winter down there. But I was raised on a farm in Southern Illinois, so I can resonate with some of this. that she's trying to describe that that light that we see in the afternoons in autumn. You know, the air seems different, doesn't it? Something's passing and something's not quite here yet, like winter, and there's a certain something going on in the air. Well, she's described it this way. There's a certain slant of light winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly, excuse me, heavenly hurt it gives us. We can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None may teach it, any. 'Tis the sealed despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. That's, if you thought of autumn quite that way before, but that's a tremendous way of talking about the change of seasons. That opening image, there's a certain slant of light, winter afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. And if you've been in winter, early winter, you know what that's like. And if you've been in a big, huge church and heard that organ suddenly sit on a big, you just feel lonely, don't you? And you don't know why. And you just almost wish winter would come or the organist would get on. But for the first couple of chords or the first, maybe what, a late November, there's a certain thing in the light. I lived in Seward, Nebraska for a while. I taught there. And that time of year around Thanksgiving would just drive me crazy because I knew something. I was like a little dog. I wanted to bark or bite tires or something. Didn't know exactly what was going on. It was the change of seasons. No wonder kids are so unruly when it rains and snows. And they feel all that. As adults, I think we get conditioned to layer over that, gloss over those feelings, and those react. We just don't react anymore. We're not supposed to. We're not supposed to jump up and down and scream, "Hey, it's autumn," or "It's whatever." Bite tires. It would be very undignified. As a result, we go around smiling and condoning little children. Say, "Well, you know, children do that." Wordsworth, in one of his poems, said, "Children come from heaven, trailing clouds of glory as they come." And he goes on to talk about those clouds of glory get covered up as we grow older and give off less sparks until finally we have so many layers of civilization on us we don't almost know how to react at all to anything. I think it's probably true. Makes for a nice, orderly, civilized society, but it's sort of dull. I guess you can't have both. A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head like one in danger. Cautious, I offered him a crumb. And he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home than oars divide the ocean, too silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap plashless as they swim. That's quite a statement about a bird, isn't it?
That reflects her time spent in the garden.
Yes, it certainly does. A couple of things going on there. You'd like to hear that again?
Mm-hmm.
All right, and this time I'll play teacher just a little bit, and I won't dissect much, but tinker a little. A bird came down the walk he did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. Well, that much says is an interesting comment on her training and her background. She's in her father's garden in the house. She's pretty much given up on being a person of the world. She's been injured in love. She's been hurt by society, by her friends, or whatever. All these things that made her decide to pull the plug and go inside, be a recluse. And so she's got to be bitter. I don't think a person makes that decision happily. For every Thomas Merton who would make that sort of a monastic decision happily, there must be thousands of Emily Dickinsons who would probably just as soon enjoy life more and be more part of life. I suppose luckily for us, she chose this way because now we have her poems. Otherwise, she'd worked in a drugstore all her life and we wouldn't know anything, I suppose. So she says, a bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. Bam, bam. That's the Dickinsonian. That's the safe on the head. And then what does he do? And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass. How nice of God to put that little drop of dew on that grass. The bird just grabbed the worm. Too bad for the worm. And then turns his head this way, and there's a little sauce on the grass. And then hops sideways to the wall to let a beetle pass. So he's had the worm. He's had the dew, and now he's full, so now he jumps and let the beetle. If he hadn't had the worm, the beetle would have been his next dinner. I see what she's saying is, isn't it nice? It's kind of a shot at Browning, Robert Browning's line, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. You know, it's the great chain of being, great medieval idea of you have God up here, and then you have kings, and you have princes, and you have landowners, and then you have the gentry, and you have priests, and then you have serfs, and the peasants, and the groundling. And wherever you are in life, you're supposed to be satisfied with your lot and not rattle the chain. Because you were born into this station, so that's your lot. Well, she says nuts to that idea. So this poem has more than a touch of bitterness in it about the bird that grabs that worm. The convenient grass is the giveaway. How nice of God to put the dew there for the bird. But you could also say, was it nice of God to let the poor worm was on his way to the drinking hole too, and all of a sudden he's cut in half. He didn't know what hit him. All right, then so she makes the statement about the bird and the worm and verse 2 stanza. Then she goes on to say, she's looking at the bird. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head like one in danger. Cautious, I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home. Then oars divide the ocean, two silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap plashless as they swim. What started out as a satiric commentary on life ended up as a nice poem about a bird. She's too good a poet to give us three more stanzas on how bitter she feels. She suddenly realized she was looking at the bird, and she decided to describe the bird as bird. And he flew off. She tried to give him the crumb. And how did he fly? The minute that bird hit that blue sky, rowed as you would row, right? As oars divide the ocean, two silver for a seam. Have you ever rowed? It's hard, isn't it? We took a boat ride on Lake Louise in Banff before coming to Holden. And chopping away and slashing away first this side, then you got to go. And I went this way. Instead of going this way, I went like tacking, and I didn't really want to do that, but I didn't know any better, I guess. Well, she's saying that's how the bird took off. Those wings just, you can't see the seams in the sky, in the air, in the blue. That's what a good poet will do. A bad poet would have started on that bitter theme and just continued and harangued until, to echo Shakespeare, methinks she would protest too much, and then you'd lose interest. Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense the starkest madness. 'Tis the majority in this, as all, prevail. Assent, and you are sane. Demur, and you're straightaway dangerous and handled with a chain. Maybe you ought to do that one again, too. That's not just a little bitter. That's the whole hammer. She's mad at the world. Much madness is divinest sense. Usually her first lines are the whole poem. Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense the starkest madness. 'Tis the majority in this, as all, prevail. Assent, and you're sane. Demur, that's, you know, back off. You're straightaway dangerous and handled with a chain. Sometimes kids' rooms, my daughters included, can look absolutely disastrous, chaos. And she seems to know where everything is, or if she doesn't know, she doesn't want it, until she unearths it like an archaeological dig. She finds some blouse or sweater or shoes that she had long since given up on. But it's the majority agrees, right? We agree what makes a sane world. And if you go to Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, as she did in Amherst, and get your education, go out and join the bridge club and play bridge with the ladies once a week, go to church every Sunday, you fall into the do your kinds of things, then you're fine. But just become a recluse or start living a different kind of a life, maybe wear an earring in your ear or a serape or who knows what. And people say, oh, it was dangerous. Better handle that prison with a chain.
Well, fashions change.
Yes, they do.
So 25 years ago, you were stepping way out of line to grow a mustache. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't dare grow a beard 25 mm-hmm. years ago.
That's right. I'm attempting one right
now. now you're out of step if you're going clean shaven.
That's right, yeah. If this keeps itching anymore, it's going to come off in a hurry. It's driving me crazy. I feel like ants all over it. Yes, it itches. It sure does. She wrote a number of poems based on death, which I think might be kind of interesting. They're kind of morbid, but they're so good that you can't talk about Emily Dickinson without getting into this. But she really wrote some of the finest poems on death we have, along with Walt Whitman. And again, that first line, first two lines, is just so full of irony. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. Well, if you didn't read the rest of the poem, you'd say, gee, that's right. But I am going to read the rest of the poem. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure, too, for his civility. We passed the school where children strove at recess in the ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun, or rather, he passed us. The dews grew quivering and chill. For only gossamer my gown, my tippet only tulle. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice in the ground. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet feel shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet feel shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. It's that great moment when you finally realize when you realize it at 6, 16, 60 or whatever, that the carriage ride has always been going towards the barn. And you may think you've got all kinds of control over the reins, but in reality you don't. Sometimes that's a very jarring moment. Back to her father's garden. Met a snake one day. She called him a narrow fellow in the grass. She could have just said snake. A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is. The grass divides as with a comb. A spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet and opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn. Yet when a boy and barefoot, I more than once at noon have passed, I thought a whiplash unbraiding in the sun. When stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people I know, and they know me. I feel for them a transport of cordiality, but never met this fellow, attended or alone, without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone. That's got to be one of the great lines in American literature, it seems to me, to describe that sudden tension of seeing a snake or almost stepping on a snake. Zero at the bone. That's beautiful. That's what poetry is about.
It's interesting in that she uses the boy.
I was just going to say that. Uh-huh. I was going to say it's interesting in that. Yeah. She uses
yeah.
You're right. You're right. Yeah, it is. Yep. Very interesting. D.H. Lawrence, in a couple of his poems, takes on the persona of the woman in the poem, and Dickinson, in a couple of her poems, will use the mask of the boy or the man. It is not all that common in literature. D.H. Lawrence does it better than anybody, I think. She has a poem in here, let's see if I can find this really fast, called I Died for Beauty. Oh, here's something else I was going to read, just I happened to come across it. It's called Faith is a Fine Invention. Faith is a fine invention when gentlemen can see, but microscopes are prudent in an emergency. It's nice, huh? Yeah, that's that dichotomy again between the Jonathan Edwards and Emerson. You know, transcendentalism is great, but if I'm going to be operated on, I hope the guy's got some little technical thing, not just saying, I'm going to intuitively sort these kidneys out here. Not sure I want that. Surgeons must be very careful. I was going to read this from Jim Gamreth. Maybe there's some more surgeons here today. Surgeons must be very careful when they take the knife. Underneath, I can't read this. Underneath their, is that fist? Why don't I put my glasses on? Maybe I can read that. It's dawned on me. I've got 4 pair of glasses. I invariably leave them in various rooms. All right. Faith is a fine. This is surgeons must be very careful when they take the knife. Underneath their fine incisions stirs the culprit life. I should not dare to leave my friend, because if he should die while I was gone, and I too late should reach that heart that wanted me, if I should disappoint the eyes that hunted so to see, and could not bear to shut until they noticed me, if I should stab the patient faith, so sure I'd come, it listening, went to sleep, telling my tardy name, my heart would wish it broke before. Since breaking then, were useless as next morning's sun, where midnight frosts had lain. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. It banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody, how public like a frog, to tell your name the livelong June to an admiring bog. She doesn't mess around, does she? How dreary to be somebody. How public like a frog. I never thought of a frog as being public. And the last couple of days, you take the trail down, you see all those little... They're out sunning themselves, and they're galumphing around, having a great time. They're very public out there. You have to be careful. You don't step on those frogs or toads, whatever they are. I never did figure out the difference between a frog and a toad. I'm told there is a difference. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? And there's a pair of us. Don't tell. It banish us, you know. Gee, I like that. Here it is. I died for beauty. I was talking about the bitterness, you know, that more than a tint of, this is the life I've chosen for myself, but she grits her teeth as she says it, you know. I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was laying in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth. Himself are one, we brethren are, he said. And so, as kinsmen met at night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names. Enough said. What? That's the safe right out of the window again. Crunch. The heart asks. Every time I turn a page, I'm on a bitter poem, on a bitter streak here, so might as well let them all get out. Okay? The heart asks pleasure first, and then excuse from pain, and then those little anodynes that deaden suffering, and then to go to sleep. And then if it should be the will of its inquisitor, the privilege to die. Not a very happy poem. Here's a poem going leaning toward the Emersonian side of truths that transcend things. You don't need to have everything proved. I never saw a moor, I never saw the sea, yet I know how the heather looks and what a billow be. I never spoke with God nor visited in heaven, yet certain am I of the spot as if the map were given. I mentioned the love affair, or it wasn't a love affair. It was a love, a platonic love. I'm sure she probably would have wished it something other than platonic, given the choice, who needs that? Except maybe Plato. But this happened twice. She had these two interests in these two men, and neither of whom knew a thing about it.
One was an editor. He really was an oaf, an oaf for sure, because he rejected a couple of her poems and then had the audacity, the gall, to write back and try to improve her. You imagine some oafish editor trying to improve Emily Dickinson. It just galls me to think about this. But anyway, she liked him and I loved him. And she wrote this poem called My Life Closed Twice Before It's Closed. And those twice has reference to those loves. My life closed twice before it's closed. It yet remains to see if immortality unveil a third event to me, so huge, so hopeless to conceive, as these that twice befell. Parting is all we know of heaven, and all we need of hell.
Was she a morbid person or a happy person?
Very happy. You wouldn't know it by some of these poems. And yet other poems, 2,000 poems, if we had a week to read, you'd see the whole spectrum of Emily Dickinson. Her letters are full of joy. She described herself in this way, if I can remember. She said, my hair is the color of the wren, my eyes the color of the sherry in the bottom of the glass that the guest leaves. What a brilliant description.
Now you see this lack of self-assurance, and all of a sudden in another line the bravado comes out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, she had it all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a brilliant videotape that's on PBS occasionally with Julie Andrews, not Julie Andrews, Julie Harris. Called The Belle of Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very good, and it gives a really good a picture of her. A sprightly, knowledgeable, full of wit, laughs at herself. I'm just reading some of the heavyweights that kind of gives maybe an impression that she was...
Did she marry another family? Or?
No, she... That was it. She was a recluse. And,
yeah,
she was a recluse that went into her father's garden house and stayed there in early 20s, and that was middle 20s, and that was it. She would go out to church once in a while, but after a while she didn't like that either. She didn't like all haranguing and thumping on the saying you're bound for hell or we need to build a new building or whatever. She didn't like that. She expected maybe a little gospel along the way somewhere and didn't quite get enough for her. So she said, Father, I'm not going to church anymore. Well, you just didn't say that to Dickinson, Mr. Dickinson. They had their own pew in the front. The carriage arrived at the right time. They all... spit and polish and went to the church, you know. So he just dismissed that. Of course you're going to church. Don't tell me you're not. I won't listen to it. All right. So on one Sunday he took out the big watch. Said it's 20 minutes till 11. The carriage is ready. In we go. And in filed his brother and in filed sister and in filed mother. And then father was standing by the door counting them off. No Emily. He said, Emily, you're going to make us all late. And he huffed and puffed and stroked his beard and took out his watch again, and no Emily. And he yelled upstairs, "Bell, no Emily." So he went upstairs, opened the door, and she wasn't there. So he started bellowing, Emily, you gotta go to church. And went downstairs, looked in the library, and no Emily. He looked out in the garden, there's no Emily. So he opened the cellar door, said, Emily, are you down there? And he heard a very faint, kind of a creaking sound, creak, creak, creak. And he walked down the stairs, Emily, we're gonna be late, where are you? Creak, 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 creak. There was a door shut, so it was kind of a root cellar. She was in there in her rocking chair. She wasn't going. And he had the door locked. And he said, Emily, let me in. Creak, 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 creak. You are now going to church. Creak, 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 creak. Not a word, just creak, creak, creak. And he pounded on the door, and the more he pounded, the faster that creaked. And finally he shrugged and gave up, and off went the carriage, and that was the last time she set foot in church. She'd had it with that, and I guess he had it trying to persuade her. Figured it wasn't worth it. I don't suppose any of you people have gone through that, of course, browbeating the entire family to get in the car, lest you be late for church. And the time you get there, you feel like cutting somebody's throat and your own and the preacher's, and you wonder why you bothered. Now, I'm sure you have experienced that. Then you sit there, perspiration running down your jaw tense, one hand on the back of your son's neck, lest he take one move. It's lovely. Okay. Let's read another one here for you. Oh, this is my letter to the world. Well, sure, two stanza poem. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. Here's that first two lines again. I sometimes wonder why she bothers to go on. She's so brilliant, two lines. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. The simple news that nature told with tender majesty. Her message is committed to hands I cannot see. For love of her, sweet countrymen, judge tenderly of me. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable, and then it was that interposed a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed. The last night that she lived, very powerful poem. They're all powerful in that way, but this has some lines, some images towards the end of the poem. This is a little bit longer than the rest of it, that I think are very powerful. The last night that she lived, it was a common night, except the dying. This to us made nature different. We noticed the smallest things, things overlooked before, by this great light upon our minds, italicized as 'twere. As we went out and in between her final room and rooms where those to be alive tomorrow were a blame, that others should exist while she must finish quite, a jealousy for her arose, so nearly infinite. We waited while she passed. It was a narrow time. Too jostled were our souls to speak. At length a notice came. She mentioned and forgot, then lightly as a reed, bent to the water, struggled scarce, consented, and was dead. And we placed the hair and drew the head erect, and then an awful leisure was belief to regulate. Very detailed, isn't it? Very concrete. The first two lines of the last stanza are just dynamite. And we placed the hair and drew the head erect. That's not. But then the real torture is, and then an awful leisure was belief to regulate. But now you have the leisure. You have to work around the person who's no longer there. It's a leisure time for you. Well, obviously, it's an awful leisure. Who needs that kind of a leisure? We would be better off if we didn't have that leisure. But that's really the pain that she's talking about. An awful leisure with belief to regulate. She's very modern. This concreteness is very modern. And I could, if there are a classroom situation, I could show you some other things she's doing in rhyme that nobody did before, and nobody's done better since. But the concreteness is very modern. Before, the American poets weren't talking like this. Ralph Waldo Longfellow was saying, "Let us then be up and doing, learn to labor and to wait." Nice, kind of homey things, or Excelsior, Evangeline, this is the fourth primeval, and all that. Nice, smooth, flowing kinds of things. Stately, dignified. Dickens is coming along and talking about placing a dead person's hair on a pillow and drawing a head erect. And people are saying, "Hey, talk about." She has that other poem I read, "I Heard a Fly Buzz When I Died." Well, nobody said things like that. Yeah, when you die, you're supposed to have a cross on your chest and the Bible open, John 3:16, and be ready to swing the beads or whatever it is you're going to do to get ready. And look at the Solomon praying hands, if that's your thing for art. But not, she says, "I saw a fly, heard a fly buzz when I died." And that's awful. She says, "Of course it's awful." Isn't it likely, though, that you might be looking around and there's all your people in the room, all of a sudden you look over here and there's this blue fly going up the curtain. And that's the last sight you see. It's very realistic. Emily Dickinson forces us into the 20th century in literature, whether we're ready for it or not. And as you might imagine, people weren't ready for it at all. Well, people very rarely are ready for it. Now we take this realism for granted, but she was the first.
Did she make any effort at all to have her work published?
Yeah, she sent a few poems into a couple of magazines. They were rejected, and a couple were accepted, and with suggestions for change. I think she published 6 or 7 out of about 1,879 that she wrote. That's about par for the course for a poet.
Did she give her sister any reason for when she answered the burden of forms when she died?
I don't know that she did or not. I'm plead ignorance on that one. Uh-huh. If she did, I'm not.
She did answer. She thought they weren't worthy, or she didn't open her room.
Well, she was such a private person, and she just became more and more private until finally she really wanted no record left at all. Mm-hmm. When you're that private, you just want to burn your manuscripts and slash the paintings and tear up the piano.
That's
and yeah, that's right.
How old was your music?
56. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
With all of that adult life and the one house.
Yes. Right.
Never even went to town.
Not very often. None at all toward the end. Mm-hmm. Things were, he took to wearing white and became really eccentric. But that term has become so, has a certain connotation for us now. Eccentric is somebody who's just a little screwy. But that's not what eccentric means. It means different. She was different. But she knew that was going to happen, you know. Demure and you're dangerous and handle with change. She said that about herself. She said, I'm letting myself in for it. I better go out and play bridge with the ladies every Thursday night. She said, I can't stand the ladies. She's got a good poem about that if I can find it. But before I find, here's another poem I should throw in. It's called I Step From Plank to Plank. I step from plank to plank, a slow and cautious way. The stars about my head I felt, about my feet the sea. I knew not but the next would be my final inch. This gave me that precarious gait some call experience. Here's a poem called The Soul Selects Her Own Society, which you might imagine a poet would write after two loves that never materialized and the people in the town calling her crazy, Emily and all that. So finally she just has enough and says, enough. Trying to think of some polite word to use. The soul selects her own society, then shuts the door to her divine majority present no more. Unmoved, she notes the chariot pausing at her low gate. Unmoved, an emperor be kneeling upon her mat. I've known her from an ample nation choose one, then close the valves of her attention like stone. In that poem about the lady in the bridge. Thursday night. She doesn't call him the Thursday night bridge club, but you know what she's talking about. What time do you all have? Is it about 10 till? 11 till? Another, how about another couple of poems, then you can get ready to eat. Let's see. Do you have any questions, comments, as I'm thumbing through here? I don't remember how. Why, what the cause was. No, a normal thing, natural death, I mean.
She must have had a live-in servant or somebody.
Well, her parents lived there. She lived with her parents all her life. Oh. And her sister and her brother was there, in and out. They got married, but they would be in and out. And you know, nephews and nieces running around. She had family. She was just, it's not all that unusual. Well, it is now, getting more and more so, but it wasn't too long ago when you could have someone in the house, you know, not married or widowed or whatever, and then Emily just had all kinds of family. She was very, very happy. I couldn't say very happy. No, not at all. I think she would have thought that ridiculous. And she had this tremendous vital imagination, and she did what very few of us do. She read. And when you have all the great books of the Western and Eastern world in front of you, and read them, and know them, you have all the company there is. But we don't do that.
You don't have time for idle conversation.
No. She put it down in poems. Okay. It is, what soft cherubic creatures, that's the name she gave for the house. What soft cherubic creatures these gentlewomen are, one would as soon assault a plush or violate a star. Such dimity convictions, a horror so refined of freckled human nature, of deity ashamed. It's such a common glory, a fisherman's degree. Redemption, brittle lady, be so ashamed of thee. I told him. Okay, maybe one more. Here's one. Well, I have been hungry all the years, which I think might be a suitable one to close with. It kind of says all kinds of things about it. By the way, you notice that her first line is the title. She never titled anything. For those of you who write can never think of titles, take heart. She didn't either. So the person who edited her book, her poems, just took the first line and stuck it up there. I had been hungry all the years. My noon had come to dine. I trembling drew the table near and touched the curious wine. 'Twas this on tables I had seen when turning hungry home, I looked in windows for the wealth I could not hope for mine. I did not know the ample bread. 'Twas so unlike the crumb the birds and I had often shared in nature's dining room. The plenty hurt me. 'Twas so new. Myself felt ill and odd, as berry of a mountain bush transplanted to the road. Nor was I hungry, so I found that hunger was a way of persons outside windows the entering takes away.